Hey, queer friends, are you ready to be inspired? Welcome to Season 5 of Coming Out and Beyond, a podcast that shares stories from the LGBTQIA+ community. Here's your host, Anne-Marie Zanzel.
Hi, this is Anne-Marie Zanzel. Welcome back to another episode of Coming Out and Beyond. I am very excited to have Cece Reagan here today. Cece is a published author and copywriter who found her calling in message strategy and alignment for all types of businesses, from entrepreneurs to billion-dollar corporations. She's also an international advocate for addiction and domestic abuse survivors, who's been featured in Newsweek and Metro, as well as several award-winning podcasts. Cece uses her vast life experience, cultivated writing talent, and an innate intuition for people to channel her clients' words into mind-blowing marketing copy. She also teaches and coaches those who want to learn the mechanics of messaging in a simple, straightforward way. Her goal is to help others find clarity in their messages so they can do what they love and find fun and freedom in business. Cece, welcome to the show.
Whoa, what a mouthful.
It's so funny. Your bio is actually nice and concise and really great. I have had different bios later, like four paragraphs long, because people have so many things they've done. And it's like, it was a wonderful bio to read.
Thank you.
So tell me your coming out story.
Well, yeah, this is what's interesting, because I feel like I don't have one. It's all for me been like the most nebulous of things. I think figuring out my sexual orientation as well as figuring out like my gender presentation and all of that is like, I feel still in the middle of it. I feel it's very ongoing. I have the type of story that like I fell in love with all my female best friends in high school. You know what I mean? Like that person. And that never really worked out, you know what I mean? I might would get drunk and tell them, and then the next day would pretend like it didn't happen. Embarrassed. But I grew up in like religion as well, and like Christianity, and I grew up in like Virginia and Carolina, like very much the Bible Belt, very much Baptist, you know, old school. Yeah. So I don't, obviously I'm not tarring everyone with the same brush, but this is what it was like for
me.
Well,
I focused a lot about that on this show, and it sounds like, honestly, that you're still on the journey.
Yeah.
And you are, I mean, typically when people, you know, tell me those stories of like telling their friends they've fallen in love with them or have a lot of girl, you know, crushes on other girls when they're in high school, it's like you're still figuring it out. And one of the most wonderful things that I promote today is that you can figure this out at whatever time of life. It doesn't have to be when you're a teenager. And I find particularly with people that identify as female, or non-binary, oftentimes that can be in their 30s or 40s. And there's a lot of cultural reasons why we don't figure out our sexual orientation until we're older. And if you grew up in Southern Baptist culture and you grew up in purity culture, you have to fight your way out of all of that before we can even consider our sexuality.
Yeah, because I didn't even feel like I was like a fully formed person. You know, I just felt like I was just like a vessel for other people's desires. Like it never occurred to me that I was supposed to like be having a good time.
No. And also too, I mean, as a woman in Southern Baptist culture, everything is your responsibility, including men's desires and men's sexual desires. And it is such a system that it really makes women, and then it goes beyond so much past sex. It's like you're responsible for men's emotional well-being. You're responsible if you have children, your children's well-being. You're responsible for so many other people's well-being. And what happens we forget about ourselves, right?
Mm. Yeah. And then when you hit your 30s, you're like, oh, I think I might be a fully formed human being with my own needs and desires.
Yeah, true. So you said that in your bio that, you know, you have done a lot of work with domestic abuse survivors and as well as addiction.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about those stories and how you ended up doing this work? Because oftentimes, you know, we become passionate about something that we have survived.
Yeah.
And so I would love to hear about your own story in regards to that.
Thank you. Well, I am, so I'm over 8 years sober at the moment.
Congratulations.
Thank you. One day at a time and all that. But I started drinking when I was like 14 and I spent like about a decade in active addiction. Nightmare. So, but I started like when my mom was sick. So she got diagnosed with a terminal illness, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease in the States. It's known as motor neuron disease over here in the UK where I live. And there's a bunch of other stuff had happened. My dad was an alcoholic, you know, this is like very much a genetic component sometimes for people. I wanted to escape. Everything was terrible and life was pain and I was 14 and life is terrible when you're 14 anyways. So I just continued drinking and I'd finally, you know, quit, was able to get any sort of sober time when I was like 24, but it took a really long time. And in the midst of all of that, when I was 16, I met this guy who was like 24, 25. And we started a relationship. He was actually like a registered sex offender, like on the registry and everything like that. But because of my past and what I had been through, because of like with, you know, with my dad and everything, because of my mom's illness, because of the drinking, I was just like perfect. You know what I mean? I was just the perfect. And I feel like these people sort of have a sense about
well,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you were in turmoil and also in grief. And so, yeah, he's a
very easy.
Yeah. You were an easy pick.
Easy. Yeah. So, which I understand that now, like, you know, it's not like all good, but it's like, I feel like a lot of people hold a lot of shame about this stuff. And I'm like, not my fault.
No, it isn't your fault. I mean, people that are registered, you know, are sex offenders often groom their victims and they know exactly what they're looking for, whether it is conscious or unconscious. You know, I mean, for some of them, I'm sure it is very conscious and it's very evil. And for some of them, it's sort of an unconscious life pattern.
I agree.
So you met this guy and you were 16, you were a baby. Had your mother passed yet? Or
she passed when I was 19.
Okay.
I moved out and in with him when I was 17. I just couldn't be in the house anymore, but I really went out of the frying pan into the fire. I was in that relationship for a really long time. It ended very badly.
Okay.
With like me having to escape the house at night, like after an altercation. I don't know. Like, I don't want to be super graphic because I don't ever want to like trigger anybody. I don't know how important like that is, but you know, it was like, it was a very scary situation. I was already planning on leaving. Mm-hmm. And I just ended up, you know, taking my little go bag and getting in my car and that was it. So I had to like find.
So you had your go bag already packed. Had you already been working with like? We'll do a trigger warning for this episode. Yeah. Had you already been doing a like working with a domestic abuse shelter at that point?
The thing is, no, because I knew that something was wrong. But this is the thing: is like when you're in it, sometimes you just can't see the wood for the trees.
Yeah.
And I knew something was wrong, but I didn't have much of a frame of reference for what that might be exactly. especially I had moved in with him when I was 17. We had worked together for a long time, but then I ended up, what kind of started to open my eyes was I got a job somewhere else and then I got promoted and I was doing well and I was working with adults who had relationships and they didn't have to ask permission and they didn't have to, you know, they could wear whatever they wanted. And I was like, oh, this is like the bare minimum.
Oh, yeah, because I guess, you know, you, I mean, first of all, you were 16. Your family was in crisis when you left that. Mm. You left that home. You had no frame of reference.
No.
None.
But I wouldn't have called it abuse. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't have reached out to anyone for help. Like, I was just trying to find, like, apartments that I could afford. And I had Googled, like, what to do. And I had my, like, I had my go bag with, like, you know, my baby book that my mom had made and all this stuff. But she had already, you know, she had passed by this point because I was 24 now. So, like, or 23, I guess, when I left him. So, yeah. But then I was able to get sober after that. Because I wasn't able to get sober with him.
And how did you approach your sobriety? What was the turning point? So, are you in the process of coming out later in life? Are you feeling isolated or lost, cut off from friends and family, or just trying to figure out what is the next step for you? Well, I have a wonderful coaching program called Lotus Group Coaching. It is for people who are female identifying, cis or trans, or non-binary folks comfortable in those spaces. And we provide emotional, spiritual, and intellectual support for people who are in the process of coming out later in life. We discuss many things in our community, but what's most important is that you have a community of others who understand. Each one of the coaches in the program have come out later in life. And everybody who is a member of our program is somewhere in the process. So if you are seeking community and you want a soft place to land, go to my website, amoryzanzel.com, and book a connection call. We would love to talk to you.
Well, I tried it. I use a 12-step program, mm-hmm. but I was back and forth for like 8 months to a year. It's very strange because I remember thinking that like I wasn't drinking, mm-hmm. but like I definitely was like every single week. Mm-hmm. And I would like, at one time I got 90 days sober, mm-hmm. and then I texted my friend that and we went and got drunk to celebrate. You see, it's like it doesn't make any sense. Finally I was able to, the thing that finally was like, oh, cease. Mm-hmm. Well, come on. I had moved down to Carolina. I was staying with my grandparents because I was gonna move here to England. And I had been basically had crashed a New Year's Eve party I wasn't invited to. Mm-hmm. And I woke up like at somebody's house and didn't really know like where I was. And it was like a family member's house. Like my friends had like taken me there and taken care of me. But and that had happened like loads of times. I'd woken up loads of times and didn't know where I was or didn't remember. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a new thing. And as a matter of fact, I was perfectly safe, but I just felt like really panicked. I had to go like in the morning and grab my purse from the lady, and like she just kind of like gave it to me and like slammed the door in my face, and so I must have done something, but I don't even know what I've done. And just sitting on the front porch like smoking a Marlboro Light, like, mm-hmm. is this it? Like this, like just shame cycle, and not like what, like this is it, this is what your life is now. And I was like, no, I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. And then I knew I was coming here to England. And mm-hmm. so I was like, I don't know. I just felt like it was sort of my shot. I was like, you can get out of this small, like one horse town. You can finally go somewhere like big and travel. And if you can't make this work, this your big opportunity, then you don't even deserve it. Mm-hmm. And then I never drank again so far. Mm-hmm.
So why England?
Well, that's a whole other thing because of my ex-husband. Mm-hmm. The thing that you said about grooming earlier was almost like a little bit of foreshadowing for people, because we met on MySpace when I was 14. Mm-hmm. He's 20 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of a family friend. So my mom worked for a musician. He ran like a fan side and did some interviews and stuff like that for this musician. So they sort of knew each other. My mom had sent him like letters and things like that. And I believe had even met him before one time, maybe. So it felt like a sort of safe person. Anyways, I was in my other relationship for a really long time, left him when I was like 23. And then me and my ex-husband started to get more like serious, like romantic, rather than like just being friends like we had kind of been before. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I was like younger, like a teenager, having a crush on him because he was like an older British guy on the internet. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? It was like interesting. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't all it was cracked up to be.
Right.
So, you know, I was just sort of like in the perfect sort of position, and he was like going to rescue me and move me to England. And it was all so whatever, but again, like wasn't what I thought. And we were married for a couple of years. I like moved over here and everything like that. And then in lockdown, mm-hmm. it became okay. The thing is with my first ex when I was younger, it was very like overt, mm-hmm. Like the abuse and things. But with my ex-husband, it was much more insidious. It was much more like mind games, that kind of stuff. And so it was harder for me to recognize. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it took me a long time, and I was surprised, actually. Like I said, in lockdown, I sort of realized what was happening, and I was like, I don't know. I was just kind of shocked to have found myself in that position where I was like, oh, I don't have like anything of like for myself, and I can't go and do, and I can't, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just, this is a gilded cage, and not even.
Right. Right.
But then I reached out for help.
Well, honestly, it makes perfect sense that you ended up with somebody else like that again. We mm-hmm. often partner with people that remind us of our primary caregivers, in mm-hmm. a sense. And we do it again and again. And also, too, it doesn't matter if we switch genders, if we go from male to female, we often partner with people that have very similar personalities. It's just mm-hmm. every human being does it. The difference is that when you meet somebody who's also able to work on their stuff and admits that they have a problem and they need to do some work on their things. And so, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you met somebody like that again. And what I love about it is your honesty about it. So you realized as a woman that you had been in two relationships now where you were limited in how, you know, in your choices because of working with that, you know, with being with them and, you know, not having certain, you know, skills and qualities. So what you realized, you hit this bottom where like, I've got to be able to support myself and to be able to, you know, be able to make choices in my life and not have mm-hmm. them by a man.
Yes.
So how did you go about rebuilding so that, I mean, here you are, you're still a baby. I mean, you're under 30, right? And you've already lived 10 lifetimes.
Well, I'm 32, but I'll take that.
Yeah, but you were 30 when you left him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were 30 or under. And so, you know, you've already lived 10 lifetimes with these guys. And so how did you rebuild?
Well, it was a really strange kind of how it went down because obviously I had to get help and I had to find housing. And so all of this stuff was sort of happening behind the scenes. And I was like playing the role and then taking my dog for a walk and like making phone calls, like when I could to mm-hmm. try to arrange things. It was mm-hmm. very that. So then when I did finally get out into my little one bed flat, which I really love, my little place by the sea, me and my dog. The next day was probably the worst, maybe the worst day of my life, which is saying a lot for me. I don't know. I just felt like I didn't know what I was going to do. I had built a foundation as far as my business and stuff. I had a financial services business that I've sold, and obviously doing the copywriting and the messaging and stuff now, but I hadn't started doing that yet. It was just the financial services stuff. It was a little bit like getting a little bit old. It was like wills and that. So it was very emotive. And I just felt like so burned out with everything. But now I didn't have anybody else. And obviously my family is not here. They're all back home in the States. So it was me. I have some amazing friends, some like amazing recovery friends that really took me in. But obviously they have their own families and things like that. So, you know, and financially it was just me. So I honestly, I just really dove into like my spiritual practices and things. In a way that I kind of hadn't before. I had been with the, you know, religious stuff, had been kind of like burned by all of that and run really, really far away from it. But in recovery, I started to find that connection again to a higher power or whatever. Practicing like gratitude for what I did have. And I just like, I would listen to songs that were motivating, like in the morning, and do a little dance and stuff. I mean, it was a slog. Like I did not want to do it, but I wanted to feel better. You know, right. I didn't want to feel like that anymore. I was like, I have spent like my whole life in pain. Like I can't remember any time where I wasn't like being dragged down by some sort of like lead balloon from like all these abusers throughout my life, and lost my mom and everything like that. I was like, I just want to be happy. So I suppose I will act as though I am.
Well, you know, the saying in AA, fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah.
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 So
was kind of that.
Yeah. Do you find yourself happy now?
Yeah, I just took the time to figure out like what I actually wanted and what I actually liked. Living alone really gave me the space to explore myself, to stop like masking as a neurodivergent, to realize that I was non-binary. You know, I'd like interspersed throughout my life had also like dated men, dated women, like, but it allowed me to explore like just my own self. You know what I mean? What did I like and want and expect, and like what was my idea of success and all of that stuff? And it all came together. But I feel like I just needed to be alone. Like I just needed to be alone for some time. Not like necessarily not dating or not going out with friends. I'd been miserable for a while. Like I wasn't, you know what I mean? I was like, I'm gonna have fun and see people and like, you know, but that was sort of the point, was like choosing to do that, not in a way that was like burying the past or trying to run away from something, but rather trying to run towards myself, like embrace myself and kind of just allowing myself the space to go out there and explore in a way that I had never been able to.
Well, I can imagine, because it sounds like you didn't have a breath until you were about 30.
No. And even then it felt a little bit kind of, because then it was just like financially dire.
Yeah. But also to, as somebody who, you know, had to restart my life in my 50s, you know, nothing like having to be responsible for yourself financially to make you be responsible for yourself financially.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. You just, I mean, you have to do it. It's, it's part of the, you know, it's, you know, I think a lot of us as women, especially women that come from conservative cultures, and it doesn't really matter if it's religious conservative or not, even progressive cultures, there is this sort of message that we get that, you know, men are supposed to take care of us and that they're going to rescue us. You know, you even said it, like you started to date the guy from England and you're like, oh, he's going to, you know, change my life if I move there and everything like that. But what we realize, I think, and you've said it too in this podcast, is that you sort of have to see yourself.
Yeah.
And you have to take a really hard look at yourself and decide what you want to do and who you want to be.
Mm. But I knew I had done it before. You know what I mean? Right. Like, I knew I had done, I was like, well, okay, I've already left one abusive relationship. I can just do it on another continent. That's fine. I was like, yeah. I got sober. Like, that's the hardest thing I'll ever do. I lost my mom when I was a teenager. Like, you think this is like, no. Like, it wasn't even an option. It was just like, okay, I'm leaving. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to restart my life. And then it was like, okay, this is what restarting your life looks like. You have no furniture.
So in this restarting of your life, had you already been copywriting and doing that type of work before the second guy?
Well, kind of, but not really. Like, I had done it for fun. Here's the thing is, like, I've always written, like, always written poetry. Like, when I was a teenager, I mean, I've got journals going back to when I was like 10, 11 years old, like always written. I just like it. My dad was a writer as well. So I guess that kind of like stands to reason. I don't know. And obviously owning my own business and everything like that, when you own your own business, as you well know, you know, in the beginning you do everything. So you're your own marketing department and everything. So I was doing all the social media stuff, learned quite a lot, and I would write bits and pieces for friends and things. They'd be like, can you write my bio for this thing? I'm speaking at this thing. And I was like, oh, sure. I love writing bios. I mean, I used to do that for my friends on MySpace. You know what I mean? So it was always peppered in through my life. And then I keep bringing up MySpace, like really aging myself.
I can, you know, I'm so surprised because you seem too young to have known about MySpace. So the people that were on MySpace were you, you know, I think it was like maybe 10 years before you. So it was very interesting that that you keep bringing up MySpace.
I don't know what this like, no affiliation. I was an early adopter, maybe. Probably shouldn't have been on it, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm just going to say the dangers of social media. And if anybody's listening to this that have teenagers, you know, maybe you shouldn't keep them away, especially if life is in a crisis situation for you, right?
Yeah, or just like get their password. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just like watch what they're doing or something. But what was I saying? Oh yeah. But then, so obviously I was getting burnt out with the financial services stuff, like I said before. So I just talked to a friend and I just had this idea. I always got compliments on my social media posts and things, like I said, with it. So I was like, whatever, I just do a post, just did like the one little, like the post on Facebook that makes like the colored background. And I was like, I'm thinking about starting to do copywriting. Like, anybody want to hire me to do like some of their social media marketing? And by the end of the week, I had my first 4 recurring clients.
That's amazing. You know that.
Yeah. Right. It's just continued to grow from there. I am incredibly grateful. Well, it's so blessed.
Like, well, it also sounds like that the universe was with you. You were like, I find that when you are headed in the right direction, then the universe sort of opens up for you. And that, first of all, as somebody who's, you know, done social media, done all these things, having 4 clients with a little tiny post like that does not happen. No. You know, it's, and you will, no. Yeah, that was just like, you know, I think the universe was taking care of you. Mm-hmm. And and you were going in the right direction. You were going where you were supposed to go.
Yeah. And I did believe that the whole time. That's the thing. Like, I had dove back into my spiritual stuff. I was like pulling my like tarot cards and stuff. And they would say like, it's crap right now, but just wait. Yeah. Like, it's really tough right now. It's coming. Look for opportunities. And I was like, what are you doing? But every single day I would say like, it's getting better. Like, this week is better than last week. Today is better than yesterday, even if it doesn't feel like it is. I was just like, it's getting better. I'm headed in the right direction. I just believed it with all my heart and soul, like, until it was true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what I'm hearing is mindset.
Yeah.
You basically had a mindset, this is going to work.
And yeah, well, it was like, there's no other option.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And what I love is that you, like, you know, it's funny because I've been doing a lot of, I meditate every single morning. And so this morning I was doing, you know, this manifest. I don't want to get into the details, but it'll take me 10 minutes to tell you. Okay. It's about manifesting by manifesting what you desire.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's what you did.
Yeah, I think so. Like I don't know if you're into all this, but it was also like my Saturn return.
So I actually know about that because I have a client that is very into astrology. And because of her, I have learned a lot about it. If you had said to me 2 years ago about it, I wouldn't know what you were talking about.
Well, it's interesting.
Every 7 years, right?
But it's sort of like, I don't know. I'm not super into astrology. I just have friends who are, right? So I know enough to be.
They're really helpful, those friends, aren't they?
Yeah, I know. But they're like something about like every 30 years, or I think it was like my first 30 years, basically looked at my chart between my astrology and my human design. And it was like, your first 30 years are going to be awful. And I was like, cool, did that. And it was like, your next 20 are going to be really good, sort of like learning the lessons and putting the stuff in place. And then from 50 on is like when you're really just recognized as the badass you are. And I'm like, cool, I'm gonna put in another 20 years of graft and like watch me when I'm like, I just feel excited. I just feel excited now. So it was, yeah, but I guess I did manifest it, if you believe in manifesting. Or maybe I just put myself on the right path and found alignment with like what I really wanted to do. Maybe it was like all the therapy and the healing, all the generational trauma, you know, maybe that was all of it, but I just kind of applied the skills that I learned in recovery. I was like, well, damn, if this could get me sober, then it can probably get me out of these dire straits.
I love that. I have some very good friends that are in recovery, and I used to do Al-Anon. And one of my friends said to me once, if you can become sober when you are young, watch out. Because the values, the things that are taught, whether you do, you know, AA or any other recovery method, it is, you can apply it to every area of your life. And that's what you did. And so, and you also got sober young. You were only 25, that 24.
Yeah.
That's young to get sober. You know, most people mess around with addiction for another 10, 15, 20 years. You were young when you got sober.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's honestly part of what kept me drinking for so long, though, is because I was young. Because like I'd go into the meetings and stuff, especially when I was like staying with my grandparents, because it was like the middle of nowhere, Carolina. And you're talking, you go into a room and it's like 15 people and they're all men and they're all over 60. And then me.
Yeah.
Very uncomfortable.
Well, yes, it is very uncomfortable. And also too, you know, part of recovery is falling off the wagon. I mean, people.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Like what you described as your early days of recovery is so typical. People, you know, until something happens where you decide, okay, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So it really sounds like you had a very typical journey, but you also didn't have good mentors within the recovery community at that point, because they were all 60-year-old men and you were a 25-year-old girl. I mean, there probably would have been a nice old guy that could have helped you, but you know, it was just like, no, I have often heard that, you know, especially people who live in rural communities, you know, the people that are in the recovery meetings, they just don't have much in common with them, and they are often men. And when you're a young woman, like, you really want to have other people that are your age being able to talk about those things. And a bunch, you know, they have a lot of wisdom, some of those guys, but it just, like, I don't feel like I'm in my community right now.
No, I was like, where's the girls? Where's the girls?
Yeah.
There were a few women, they were older. We would do some stuff together. Like, I was just like shoehorning friendships. It's not necessarily that like I didn't like them or anything like that, but you know, it was just like, oh, there's four women that come to this meeting sometimes that live in a 30-mile radius. So here's my number. Text me if you want to ride, you know?
please call me.
Yeah, like it was very that. And they helped me a lot. And one of the ladies like took me through my first like three steps so I could do my steps. And then I moved over here and then I finished the rest. But you're right. Those like skills, I mean, putting your whole life and everything you've ever done into a spreadsheet, like everything you've ever done wrong and everything everybody's ever done wrong to you and then how it's affected you, like into a spreadsheet and writing it down and looking at it in black and white was, that was horrendous. But I'm really glad that I did it, you know, because that's what allowed me to take responsibility for what was mine and to let go of what wasn't mine, to stop like blaming myself for getting into these relationships and to be like, well, of course you did. Like it would have been crazy if you hadn't.
Well, like when you told me the story, I'm like, of course you did. Like, yeah. I mean, like, of course you did. Mm-hmm. And learning to, you know, I in my groups, I practice radical self-compassion. And that's what it seems like you have learned over the years is to like let go of things that you have control of, don't have any control over. And just beat yourself up for choices when you had no other choice. Or just no other idea about the world.
Yeah. And nobody else has had to live with the consequences of those decisions as much as I have. Like I have paid my dues. I've paid the price. I mean, I still have like family that doesn't talk to me. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. Like that's about them and not about me. And there's like, I can't do anything about it. Like, does it hurt my heart? Yeah. Do I beat myself up about it and feel guilty? No.
No. Well, things can hurt your heart, but you don't have to carry that pain.
Yeah, it's not about me, really. Like this, you know, I messed up and like, yeah, definitely did. Like, I apologize to the people who would hear my apology. I left the people alone who I thought if I approached them, it would only make things worse. And I just don't treat people like that anymore. I don't act the way that I did when I was in active addiction. Thank God. That's why I have like such a nice life now. So many nice people, because people actually want to hang out with me now. But that's all I can do. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you've been through a lot. And I asked three questions at the end of this podcast. I really loved your story, Cece. I really appreciate that because I know that there's a ton of women out there that have very similar stories. Mm. And just the way you sort of overcome it. And I think both of us understand that, yeah, it's scary as hell to try to like figure out a new life after being with somebody for a long time, but you can do it.
Yes.
You can do it. And I think both of us are examples of that. And so I really appreciate your story. And I also appreciate that you created a new life for yourself. So I asked three questions at the end of this podcast. What is your coming out song since you really never came out?
Okay. It's I Believe in a Thing Called Love by The Darkness. Mm-hmm. Because you know that song, I Believe in a Thing Called Love.
Yeah, that one. I love that. That's a great dance. Was that one of your dancing songs when you were 100%. Dancing? I bet that's a really fun song to dance to.
I also think if I was a wrestler, that would be my walkout song. No one can take it.
That would be a great one. A book or movie, something that really changed your perspective on life.
Oh, okay. The book called The Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer. Mm-hmm. Life-changing. She was like, she is they've come back together. The Dresden Dolls, my favorite band, like indie band. She's an artist and she's fully self-supporting through Patreon. It's people like me and her fans who support her. And she started out as a living statue, the 8-foot bride in Boston. Mm-hmm. And the whole book is about asking for what you need and people will give it to you. And there's no shame in asking and this sort of thing, because I think a lot of times we don't ask for what we want. A lot of people get in their own way. I see it a lot, like, especially with what I do in business now with the messaging and stuff, people get in their own way, but it happens in life and in business. And that was just a huge shift for me. The audiobook is incredible as well. She plays the ukulele.
Ah, okay. I'm going to go. I've learned about so many books from my guests. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go get that one. And How would you describe your day, your life today, Cece?
It's life beyond my wildest dreams. It's what they say. When I started the 12 steps, if anybody is familiar with the promises, mm-hmm. it's like we will stop like self-serving behavior, like self-sabotage will slip away. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will understand that our higher power is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Like this whole thing of like all these promises, I have chills now because when I first read it, like, and heard it read out loud, like in those first early days, like I could cry because that is like the promises. I was like, well, I'm just, you're promising. I'm going to believe you. Like, I'm going to believe the promises. And I just clung so hard to it. And through all like the difficulties and stuff, I just remembered like the promises. And now that's what I feel like. I do feel like, you know, it's not that life is easy. It stopped being difficult. It's like that I either know how to handle stuff now, have the tools or the ability to ask somebody who's better equipped than me, and the gumption to do so.
I love that. And I really love those four ways. And there are four really wonderful pieces of advice. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you
for being on the show today, Cece. Good luck in your journey. And I can't wait to see where you are when you're 50.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Coming Out and Beyond, LGBTQIA+ Stories with Anne-Marie Zanzel. New episodes of the Coming Out and Beyond podcast drop every other Friday. You can tune in at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and at annemariezanzel.com. Be sure to hit subscribe when tuning in so you never miss an episode. And for more resources, articles, videos, and a free downloadable guide for coming out later in life, visit annemariezanzel.com.